said that they need more engineers and more scientists, not less. In other words, that would be producing less less people that are going to use the Pell grants. So it sounds like they're going to have to do this another way. Also, they're also starting to make changes. You know, the original plans were 2028, I think you said. Well, they were going to land, create a spacecraft that was reusable, that would land and then come back up. Now they've switched back to the old LEM system, where you come down with basically essentially two vehicles, and then you use the first vehicle as a launching pad, and essentially nothing becomes reusable. So they're cutting costs, and also on the Gateway project, you said they're going to cut back on a module, so it sounds like they're cutting costs on that as well. So I don't know, that doesn't sound possible right now. They would need a lot more money.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Paul. I kind of think that the NASA director is kind of speaking to an audience of one and trying to use this idea as the premise for advancing his budget higher. I don't think in anyone's wildest imagination at NASA they think that they could accelerate this program. You can't speed up these things too fast, or else you have to basically increase the risks of everything going kablooey on you. So I don't know. I think this is all public relations, unfortunately, and lots of talking and pleading and asking and promising, and very little, I think, is going to come of it, but we'll keep up with the news on it.
Yeah, okay. Not too long ago, they were talking about decreasing the amount of test flights on the space launch system. You know, they wanted to launch the space launch system, send it around the moon without a crew, and bring it back. And they were trying to push, this administration was trying to push, let's do away with that, just put a crew in it. You know, by the way, they're looking at cutting safety. So, you know, that's not going to fly. You know, not after all the problems NASA has dealt with over the decades. They're not going to let the same thing happen that happened with Columbia or Challenger, or even the fire in Apollo 1. You know, these were all similar mistakes. Let's hurry up and see what happens.
Yeah, I think this is all attempt of the ultimate photo op, unfortunately, and thankfully NASA is a good old bureaucracy like any other bureaucracy. Nothing runs quickly. So the faster you tell them to go, the slower they get. So I think this is going to go the way of the military march in Washington and all the other interesting, curious ideas out there. But yeah, it'll generate some press, it'll generate some congressional meetings, certainly, and some silly things that the politicians and administrators tend to say at them.
Yeah, if they want to just switch money instead of just raising taxes, you could take some money from the military space program. You know, not even the military itself. The military space program is roughly twice the amount of money that NASA gets. NASA's getting, I think, this year they're going to get like $21 billion. Previous years, you know, they were, maybe 5 years ago, they were down around $18 billion. They're creeping up little by little. I think that they might get $21 billion right now. But the space portion, the space funding, nothing to do with NASA. You know, you have all these spy satellites and everything going up. Is roughly twice the amount of money that NASA gets, so it's probably, you know, $40 billion. You know, shift a couple of billion dollars from that group, you know, leave some of their you know, work up in the air for a while, and just shift it over to NASA, and then maybe they could get that money. But that's about it. I mean, you're going to need, like you said, what, an extra five billion a year? So they're going to need quite a bit. Back to you, Roy. WS2M.
Yeah, I perfectly agree with you. The problem, though, is at least in the Senate, it's not going to happen. Those guys are not going to take a dollar away from the military. As it is, I got a story that may or may not come up before 11 o'clock. Ted Cruz actually got on the Senate and complained that we need a space force to protect us from space pirates. So these guys really, really, really want to fund something in space, and it's not research or you know, any kind of science. It's you know, who has the biggest gun possibly up there in space? I don't know what they're quite looking for, but they're nowadays they're looking for space pirates.
Okay, well, that would be funded not through NASA, then that would be through the space military budget, correct?
Indeed, that was one of the reasons why Ted Cruz came out for funding the Space Force initiative.
Oh, yeah, whatever happened to that? Mike Griffin was supposed to, maybe he's so old if they ever get that going. He was going to be in charge of that. He's a ham. His call starts with an N. It comes out of Pennsylvania. I forgot it's called. N3-something. But Mike Griffin, he was in charge of NASA. He was administrator for quite a few years. But now they were talking about him being in charge of the Space Force. I think we talked about that on the net here. But, I forgot about that. I guess they put that on the back burner for now. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed. The last I read from anything that made sense to me was that they're going to keep it folded in to the Air Force. And I think, for the most part, all they're going to do is change the stationery a little. And that'll, you know, probably only cost a few million dollars. Hey, on to the next topic. For those who have grown tired about global climate change, microplastics in our environment, and whether radio waves from our cell phones will cause any problems in time, comes a new thing to be afraid of, brought to you by the French Agency for Food, Environment, and Occupational Health, your new LED light bulb. In a 400-page report, the body cautioned it could cause an irreversible loss of retinal cells and lead to a common cause of blindness. The French agency urged officials to revise the maximum limit for exposure to LED lights, especially the ones that emit a large amount of blue light. LED phone tablets and laptop screens are not believed to be a risk to eye damage, but intense bulbs used in car headlights may, it suggested. The report distinguished between acute exposure of high-intensity LED light and chronic exposure to lower-intensity sources. While less dangerous, even chronic exposure can accelerate the aging of retinal tissue and contribute to poor vision, the agency said. Long-lasting, energy-efficient, and inexpensive LED technology has gobbled up half of the general lighting market in a decade. Let me drop for a sec. And industry experts predict its share will continue to rise, topping 60% by the end of next year. Now, LEDs use roughly one-fifth of the electricity needed for an incandescent bulb of comparable brightness. Now, the basic technology for producing white light combines a shortwave LED such as blue or ultraviolet with a yellow phosphor coating. The whiter or colder the light is, the greater the proportion of blue in the spectrum usually. LEDs are used for home and street lighting, as well as in offices and industry. They're also increasingly found in auto headlights, torches, and some toys. Because the crystalline lens in their eyes is not fully formed, children are particularly susceptible to such disruptions, the French agency noted. Interfering with the body's circadian rhythm is also known to aggravate metabolic disorders, such as diabetes, as well as cardiovascular disease and some forms of cancer, noted a researcher and project manager at the French agency. Job present. In addition, a stroboscopic effect in some LED lights provoked by tiny fluctuations in electrical current can induce headaches, visual fatigue, and a higher risk of accidents, the report said. For domestic lighting, the French agency recommended buying warm white LED lighting, limiting exposure to LED sources with a high concentration of blue light, and avoiding LED screens before bedtime. The report also says that manufacturers should limit the luminous intensity of vehicle headlights, some of which are too bright at this point. Finally, the agency cast doubt on the efficacy of some anti-blue light filters in glasses and in some sunglasses. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2 GX. Okay, I thought people would be kind of interested if their LEDs are going to make them blind someday. But, okay, on to the next. So let me drop and then we'll move on to the next story.
The only thing we can do is concur.
You can concur or you could doubt. There's a whole different bunch of spectrums of behavior. There's some degree of chicken little in blue light. There's been a big move in the last few years. I don't know if you've noticed. Apple has a feature that changes the color hue of its display and shifts it to a warmer color hue as the after a certain time of night. Optometrists are asking people to pay extra for slightly tinted lenses that you use when you're reading on computer terminals and such that block some of the blue light. There's not a lot of research that really suggests that that's effective, but people are doing it. So, you know, there's always a degree of skepticism. So, you know, it could go either way, but, you know, you have to be mindful. I always favor the warm LED lights to the cold blue ones. I don't know. I'm just used to incandescent lighting, I guess.
Oh, I, too, favor the warm white. I love warm white. And also, I mean, I see these blue lights coming at me on the road all the time. It's a headache and a half. And I see all these LEDs popping up around the neighborhood around me with these blue lights. And they're a pain in the half. WB2GXM.
WS2N. You had a double there with John and KC2SHO. There was a problem there. He was coming out on the Selden machine as you were talking.
Okay, John, if you're out there, please tell me what I missed.
Yeah, sorry for that. It's a little harder to get in with the IRLP note. I was wondering, what's inside the bulb? Are they just putting a diode in there? Is there a full rectifier bridge? Is there any smoothing? You know, how are they keeping the flicker out? And I imagine that might vary from a cheaper product to a better product. If you have any comment on that. AC2GF, KC2SHO.
John, well, as you mentioned, it basically depends upon the manufacturer and his price point. There are some Chinese light sources for growing questionably illegal plants that have a high degree of flicker because they are not using any smoothing capacitors and they're just rectifying 60-cycle hum, which introduces a great deal of flicker. As it becomes more and more of a consumer item and people are willing to pay a couple of bucks more, there's all kinds of lovely electronics that smooth the signal out so that there's no visual flicker. But even despite that, flicker is not kind of written in stone. Some people are capable of recognizing flicker at higher frequencies than other people. Some people will notice it in their periphery. It's very common for the light receptors at our periphery to be much more sensitive to flicker than the central ones. And so sometimes people will kind of see the fixture flickering in the just out of view almost, and then when they lock on to the bulb, there's no flicker. So flicker is in the eye of the beholder, unfortunately, but you can go either way. Like I said, it depends upon the manufacturer and their interest in spending a buck.
Yeah, thanks for that. And, I find it impressive how they've managed to make now the decorative bulbs from LEDs. We were talking about this not too long ago at work with my boss, and he was saying that, we were postulating that we assume that now the LEDs are inside some type of phosphorescent tube or something to help minimize the sort of individual cells and give it a look as if there's a glowing element in there. Have you studied that at all?
Well, I mean, that's one approach to the general method that they're using now is to use either a deep blue or a UV LED and to whip up a complex little combination of phosphors that produce the other primary colors that give us the sense of white. So theoretically, you could do the same thing with separate ports. You could take an LED that's ultraviolet, stick it in a fluorescing tube, and have it glow like a fluorescent a tube.
Pretty cool. Neat stuff that they're doing. There's not too many incandescents or CFLs left in my house. They're all quickly getting replaced with LEDs, so no real effects that I've noticed yet. Maybe I'm buying something decent quality, but I have heard of people at work kind of going through this optical stress where they end up not feeling well. Maybe it's a combination of the computer monitor and the lights, and I wonder if it's possible if they're beating against each other, if there's any chance of that happening.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening in some cases. With light bulbs, there are so many variables. There are dimmable and non-dimmable. So if you buy a non-dimmable LED and then you hook it up to a dimmer, you'll be very upset and annoyed. Sometimes the electronics produces a hum, which can be quite annoying. But in addition, years and years ago, my nephew complained to me that when he was working on his laptop computer, he was getting intense pain in his eyes. And when I actually looked at what was going on, the fixture had Philips LED, the color-encoded changeable remote bulb, and it was flickering just and beating against the refresh rate of his LEDs on his LCDs. So it would give anyone stabbing eye pain. It was terrible. He had to learn to turn off the LED bulbs when he was operating his computer and use some other form of light.
Yeah, I thought that was a possibility, and thanks for confirming that. So I wonder, I feel like maybe places like where we work should put out some kind of statement, If you're working at the computer, you don't necessarily need overhead light all the time, or maybe people could put a little, lamp on their desk or something so they can turn those big overhead, ultra bright LEDs off. Anyway, real good. Thanks for the comments. Much appreciated. KC2GF, KC2SHO.
Welcome, John. Anyone with any other comments or questions or statements or what have you, or I'll move on to yet the next story. Redulk, our modern world is a complicated affair. Often we cannot predict how one change will affect other things here on good old Mother Earth. In March, the Federal Communications Commission began auctioning blocks of the 24 gigahertz spectrum, which could be used to implement future 5G networks. Shortly afterwards, the United States Navy released a memo warning that 5G in the 24 gigahertz band could interfere with weather satellites. Now Senators Ron Wyden and Maria Cantwell are urging the FCC not to allow wireless companies to operate 5G in that spectrum until weather forecasting operations are protected. The senators wrote a letter to the FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, recently, citing the Navy's memo and accusing the FCC of ignoring the serious alarm the scientific community is raising. The concern raised in the original Navy memo is that weather forecasts could be lost or degraded due to interference from 5G operation in the 24 gigahertz band. As the memo explains, the Navy relies on forecasts from NOAA at NASA that used remote sensing in the 23.6 to 24 gigahertz band to determine water vapor. While the FCC isn't auctioning the spectrum band that NOAA and NASA rely on, studies show the adjacent 5G band, 24.25, can interfere with critical data collection. The Navy asked the FCC to reduce bleed-over limits to protect the 23.6 to 24 gigahertz bands and to work with NOAA and NASA going forward. Let me drop for a second. In the letter penned recently by Wyden and Cantwell, they warned that to continue this down the path the FCC is currently on, quote, could lead to dangerous impacts on American national security, to American industries, and to American people, end quote. They asked the FCC not to award any final licenses in the 24 gigahertz spectrum until the FCC approves band protection limits deemed necessary by NASA and NOAA. The senators asked PI for additional information, which they requested by June 11th. As their letter states, leadership in 5G networks and devices is undoubtedly critical to our economic and national security, but only if it meets the scientific community standards. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I'm looking at the amateur radio band chart, and we're part of that 24 gigahertz. From 24 gigahertz to 24.25 gigahertz. So I wonder when all these things, if they're auctioned off, if the ARRL is going to get involved. I mean, there aren't many people there, but you know, it's still part of the ham band. I wonder if there's going to be any problems with cell phones, everything that you're talking about on 5G.
Is that a shared frequency, or is that owned totally by us?
I don't see an exception. Let's see, all I see is except novices are authorized, or modes on the... No, I don't see anything about an exception. Maybe that's not on this chart. So it looks like it's out all hours according to this chart, unless I'm missing something.
Okay, I mean, some band plan charts just tell you what kinds of transmission parameters are allowed. They don't usually specify, because there are some frequencies that are totally amateur radio. There are others that have to be shared among other agencies, and if there's interference, someone up in the FCC has to deal with who has preference and such. So I'm thinking that it's something along those lines, that it's a shared commodity, and I'm not that warm and fuzzy about the FCC protecting our rights these days.
Oh, I concur. But this one, well, this is the one that comes in QST most months now, so I just made a copy of it, laminated it. Now I have an up-to-date version of it. But yeah, it's probably in this month or last month. It's been in there for probably the last year or so, I guess. But this is, let's see. Well, this is as of 9/22/2017. It's a couple of years old, but I don't think they've changed anything.
Yeah, my revision is April 25th, 2017, and I think they just changed a couple little details. It's a kind of bare-bones band plan. It doesn't really have a lot of extraneous information. Amateur radio operators don't need to know where they're supposed to be and not supposed to be. So there's probably other places that give a better indication, because I'm aware that there are shared frequencies. I just don't recall which ones they are.
I realize that. Yeah. I'm just looking to see if there are any on this list here. Nope. I'm not seeing it. Yeah, but I do. I remember too. You know, there's certain bands that are shared with somebody else where they have a priority. Back to you, Roy.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, VDH.
Yeah, I know that, well, actually two comments. I know water vapor, I think, absorbs very heavily in the 22 gigahertz region. I'm wondering if that's what this article is about. And on the other comment, yes, with the present political structure, we stand to lose a lot of things, quite a few of the frequencies up there, especially in the millimeter range of the microwave bands there. Okay.
Well, it's possible that they're using the frequency directly as a moisture detection device. The article I got this from wasn't the most technical, and they made it rather vague that they were using the frequency to communicate the results of these moisture readings. But it's very possible, as you suggested, that it's at the very nub of the moisture readings, and important for that reason, that they can't simply dial it to a different frequency because it just wouldn't work.
Yeah, that's what I remember hearing about, is that water vapor does absorb quite readily in that range, so that probably has to do with the measurement of atmospheric water vapor that's present. Go ahead.
UGZ.
UGZ.
Hey, good evening. So I dug into this a little bit ago, and I'm going from my the attention span and memory of a gnat. So I believe the way it works is these satellites kind of look back at Earth, and areas that have, in other words, the higher concentration of water you have in the aperture of the antenna, the more energy is reflected at that frequency, or reflected from elsewhere, or in other words, so it sees energy in the aperture and it knows how to map it out as more water vapor, and the more energy it sees, the more water vapor it sees, or the more water vapor it reports. And this is very similar to that sort of light squared thing a number of years ago, where you kind of have incompatible technologies side by side, right? So if you have space-based stuff talking back to Earth, it's not that big a deal. But a lot of this stuff, in other words, a lot of subscriber units on Earth would end up polluting that spectrum where they're looking for energy and falsely report water vapor where there isn't any, with what would presumably be out-of-band emissions.
Okay, very good. Thanks a lot. It makes perfect sense to me. And again, this was not the most technical article, so it didn't have any technical details to it, so you had to infer a bunch. But that certainly makes a great deal of sense. I hope they figure it out. I would assume there are such wide swaths of bands that they're planning for 5G, you'd think that they could just kind of narrow the range there around 24 gigahertz without impacting too much coverage.
Right. One of the concerns is, and I'm actually looking now real quick to see if I can find some more information on that. They're concerned with low cost devices. In other words, yeah, they could. Well, as I say, they could probably better filter future aircraft. But again, if you have an out of band emission from a nearby adjacent channel, you can't do anything with energy that's on frequency. So, as I dig through this, let me drop real quick. Okay, what I'm trying to find is the graph that gave us the information on this, and I want to see if I can find it. And yes, I can. Okay, so integrated water vapor has a peak. They measure changes in the 23.8 gigahertz emissions to detect water indirectly. So the more water there is, the more, I guess, 23.8 gigahertz energy is reflected. And let me drop it again real quick. I'm trying to see if I can find if I can read it. A pretty good article with a bunch of good comments is up on Ars Technica, ArsTechnica. So I suspect if you just web search that,
The title of the article is 5G Likely to Mess with Weather Forecasts on the Ars Technica, A-R-S-T-E-C-H-N-I-C-A site. And go into the comments and there's a lot more technical info.
Hey, good idea. I have a link to, as I said, a far less technical Engadget article, but I'll do a little bit extra search and see what's going on. I hope they figure out something that's not going to screw up scientific research. These are not good days for science. Knowledge is not really valued that much. On to the next story. Genetics is an exciting new field in biology and may in its time redefine humanity literally. But you gotta crawl before you run. So in that spirit, scientists created a variant of E. coli bacteria with an entirely synthetic genome, according to a new paper. Building and replacing the large entire genome yet was just one goal of the team from the Medical Research Council's Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge, United Kingdom. They hoped that the resulting bacteria would use a reduced number of possible DNA base pair combinations in order to produce the 20 amino acids. In the future, the now obsolete sequences might be used to never-before-seen amino acids and proteins. The thrust of the paper wasn't just to rebuild the bacteria's genetic code, but to simplify redundancies in order to have more genetic code to work with to create custom genomes. Genetic code is written in four letters, A, T, C, and G, which represents the molecules adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. These nucleotides can arrange into 64 three-letter codons, most of which correspond to amino acids, the building blocks of proteins that allow life to function. All but two of the amino acids are encoded by multiple synonymous codons. The researchers wanted to see if they could rewrite the E. coli bacteria's genome with fewer codons, like rewriting the dictionary, but representing all hard K sounds with only the letter K instead of sometimes using C or Q as the English language does. Let me drop for a second. Producing the genome required first drafting it. The researchers designed a genome where they replaced two codons that encode the amino acid serine with synonyms that did the same with the stop codon, which tells the cellular functions when to stop reading a strand of DNA while building a protein. Then, the researchers built their DNA using various lab techniques already employed in synthetic biology. Finally, they had to replace the bacteria's genetic material with the synthetic DNA. They couldn't just transfer it all over. They had to break their genome into places, slowly transplanting bits of it into living bacteria until they had replaced the entire E. coli genome, according to the paper published in Nature. The E. coli survived, though they grew slower and were longer, according to the New York Times reporting. But the new E. coli cells relied on only 61 rather than 64 total codons. Let me drop for a second. Science fiction speculation aside, there are several potential uses of a synthetic genome like this. There are obviously biotechnological applications. Removing the redundancies allows researchers extra codons to experiment with, potentially to develop new amino acids, proteins, and bacteria that can do new things. The codon swap is also a firewall against viruses that might try to hijack, said Ellis. It's a rapidly evolving field, and this is just one of several groups in the midst of performing these kinds of genome swaps. The methods that the researchers use to swap the genome provide a blueprint for future genome synthesis, according to the paper. And next up, the researchers hope to figure out how much more they can streamline that E. coli genome as well, as they can do with the codons that they freed up before. Anyway, this is, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, so basically scientists are kind of giving us the Reader's Digest version of a bacteria. Just the facts. Anyway, let me drop and I will move on to the next story. Start by saying I hope no one out there has stock in Monsanto. But Monsanto company lost a legal battle over its massively popular Roundup herbicide, this very past Monday to the tune of $2.055 billion, with a jury in San Francisco ordering the court to pay out the stunning sum to a couple that said it caused their non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. That figure consists of $2 billion in punitive damages and $55 million in compensatory ones. Is all but certain to be reduced by the trial judges on appeal. But it's still yet another blow to Monsanto, which lost two prior suits in San Francisco and is further awaiting an estimated 13,000 other lawsuits that remain pending around the country. The plaintiffs in the case, Alva and Alberta Pilad of Livermore, California, said they used Roundup once a week for 9 months of the year for more than three decades before being given their cancer diagnosis in 2011 and 2015, respectively. Let me drop for a second. Quote, we wish that Monsanto had warned us ahead of time of the dangers of using Monsanto, and that was something in the front of their label that said, danger may cause cancer, end quote. Alberta Pilliot said at a press conference, quote, it's changed our lives forever. We can't do the things that we used to be able to, and we really resent Monsanto for that fact, end quote. Monsanto, which is owned by the German pharmaceutical giant Bayer AG, denies that Roundup and its key ingredient, glyphosate, are carcinogenic or that the herbicide poses a health risk when used according to labeled instructions. It also is insisting its legal fortunes could change. It also is insisting its legal fortunes could change as none of these three cases in California have yet to appeal to the court. The World Health Organization and the National Agency for Research on Cancer did deem Roundup a probable carcinogen in 2015, and though the evidence was mixed and partially based on animal studies, some scientific research has backed that classification. The Environmental Protection Agency's official position is that there are no risks to public health when glyphosate is used in accordance with its current label, and that glyphosate is not a carcinogen. The EPA reiterated its stance at the end of April. However, Monsanto has also faced accusations that it benefited from a cozy relationship with the EPA officials and that it interferes with supposedly independent scientific reviews that concluded that Roundup is safe. Let me drop for a sec. Ultimately, the size of any award that may end up being handed out remains unclear, though the gap between $2 billion in punitive damages and $55 million in compensatory damages is a 36-to-1 ratio that far exceeds the typical 4-to-1 ratio judges usually set as caps in most circumstances. It also seems to fly in the face of a 2016 California Supreme Court ruling that found the ratio of punitive to compensatory damages in successful lawsuits should almost never exceed 9-to-1. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okie dokie, here's my last story for the night and the one that I mentioned earlier. Washington was not always known for deep thinkers, but these days I am seriously considering if someone has drugged their water supply. This past week, as part of an effort to support the President's Space Force Initiative, Senator Cruz, junior senator for Texas and past presidential candidate, seemed to propose that we need to fund the proposed Space Force to protect ourselves from space pirates. Senator Ted Cruz issued this dire warning at a hearing titled The Emerging Space Environment, Operational, Technical, and Policy Challenges. During the hearing, Cruz gave a brief overview of human space exploration and outlined what he felt some of the important reasons for the creation of the Space Force were. Quote, of course, there are valid reasons for other spacefaring nations to conduct military activities in space, just like the United States already does, and has done for decades, whether we call it a space force or not, end quote. And then Cruz gave this particular reason, quote, since the ancient Greeks first put to sea, nations have recognized the necessity of naval forces to maintain a superior capability to protect waterborne travel and commerce from bad actors, pirates. Threaten the open seas, and the same is possible in space. In this same way, I believe we too must now recognize the necessity of a space force to defend the nation and to protect space commerce and civil space exploration. Space pirates. Politicians say the darndest thing. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okie dokie, this is your tax dollars in action. So just want to keep you aware of what's going on there in Washington, D.C. They're all acting quite strange these days. Anyway, it's coming up close to 11 o'clock. It's about 12 minutes to 11, but the next story is rather long, and I don't want to interrupt any of Paul's time. So I just want to thank everyone who participated with the puzzlers and the stories and such. Thanks to Dick, and thanks to Paul, as always, giving me the opportunity to do this. And everyone, once again, that if you have any topics, if you have any questions, if you have any reputations, if you have any puzzlers, I'd love to get puzzlers because these things are kind of difficult to come up with. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. All of these stories will have links on my page, roy.ac2gs.com, roy.ac2gs.com. And tell your friends that if they can't get into Echolink and they need an audio stream, I usually try and set one up at technet.ac2gs.com. So thanks to everyone, and next week we'll have some new stories and even a new puzzler. So over you to you, Dick, who will then hand it over to Paul.
Yes, Dick, for the next week, if you can, about Carl Sinatron. We could talk about it then, Georgia.
We might be able to do that. Not sure, but we'll see. And as far as that other story, you've got Roy. Hold on to it. If Paul runs out of material before the end, we'll go back to you. So, Paul, WS2N, what's happening in space? K2RIW in the TechNet. You got a Paul.
This is WS2N. Yes, I don't have all that much, and that would be a good idea. We could fill in the last part of the net with something that Roy didn't cover yet. First of all, Dick, how's my transmission, or should I go over to the other input?
You are sounding beautiful tonight. Please continue.
Okay, yeah, I was listening to part of the net on the other frequency, but naturally I wasn't listening to my own transmission. I know you do that, but I find that a little difficult. Roy mentioned earlier the new name for the space program that they plan on putting people on the moon by 2024 is called Artemis. And, you know, they always have to have a name. The last one was Constellation. That was back in the Bush administration. And they had all kinds of ideas and actually hardware and ready to go. And that was all canceled. You know, Constellation went out the window. But they had a lander planned and different ways of using the solid boosters that they used for the shuttle. So, Now they have Artemis, and Artemis is going to be a system using the Space Launch System, bringing multiple modules up into lunar orbit, and that's called Gateway. And then from Gateway, you'll have this lander that the crew would get into, go down to the moon, and then leave the bottom part there. It would be a two-piece vehicle. And the top part would be the ascent module. So you'd have the descent module and the ascent module, similar to what you had with the LEM, except bigger. The LEM was around almost two stories, around 23 feet high. And that was for, you know, both modules. This module would be, they say, this spacecraft would be about two stories high. For the first stage, so that would be a difference. So that would be like putting another stage on top of the existing LEM, and that would be the ascent stage to get you back to Gateway. But nevertheless, they named this thing Artemis, and there was a book that came out named after Artemis. I remember Roy said he read it. I read it as well, and it was by the writer Andy Weir. Andy Weir was the one that wrote the famous book now called Martian, which was eventually they made a nice movie out of it. So, you know, his next book was Artemis. Artemis is a fictional colony on the moon, and the whole story revolves around that colony. So when he heard about this, he sent the message out saying that NASA has named their planned 2024 lunar mission Artemis. And he said, I mean, it's because she's the twin sister of Apollo and the goddess of the moon. Same reasons I named my fictional city on the moon after her. So he says, I'm going to pretend that they named it after my city. Let me drop it. So I thought that was interesting. He put his two cents in, didn't get all wound up or claim copyright infringement or anything. But Artemis is the twin sister of Apollo. Now, Apollo had a lot of brothers and sisters in mythology, but this one was the twin sister. And turns out in mythology, Artemis killed Orion, or it's one of the versions of, you know, they have multiple stories, but apparently that's one of the stories that she actually killed Orion off. It's interesting because the other vehicle that's going to be taking the crew of four to the moon every time they go is called Orion. So I don't know whoever thought this up, if they ever looked into, I guess, classical literature or mythology or whatever this is, they killed off the vehicle that's supposed to bring Artemis eventually to the landing on the moon. So I just want to bring that up, and that's just a piece of trivia I thought was interesting. We'll see if that happens. We talked about that earlier. I don't think it's going to happen. Eventually they'll do it, but not in 2024. Now, one of the landing vehicles that are supposed to be doing this is, there's a number of them being proposed, but one of them that actually is all drawn up and they have a mock-up version of what it's going to look like is something called Blue Moon. Blue Moon is by the company Blue Origin. Blue Origin is owned by Jeff Bezos, who is the owner of Amazon. So the richest guy in the world is part of this whole plan. Plans of building this cargo first and eventually capable of carrying a crew that will be able to commute back and forth from the moon to Gateway. There's other companies, including Lockheed, and, you know, maybe they'll get the go-ahead to do it. And they'll all compete for this, or maybe eventually they'll have multiple vehicles with that capability. But Blue Moon is the land that Blue Origin is planning on building. It's about that size. It's about, the first stage is about two stories high. And he showed plans of it, and he has been working on an engine called the BE-7, which he plans on building for that lunar lander. It's not developed yet, but he's been working on it for a couple of years. It's about not 100% ready to go. Another one that is almost ready to go is the BE-4, or is a liquid methane, liquid oxygen engine. He plans on making up seven of these and put them on the first stage of a rocket he's calling the New Glenn. Now each engine is going to be a little over 500,000 pounds of thrust. So he plans on putting seven on the first stage and eventually another engine that he's developed and flown already called the BE-3 for the second stage. The BE-3 has flown 11 successful times without a crew yet, but by the end of the year you might see that happen as well, and that's on the New Shepard, and that's suborbital flight. So he's developing these BE-4 engines for these booster vehicles, and what's happening is he needs a test stand to test these another engine he's also developing. It's now for Blue Origin. So he's now taking over a stand in Alabama that NASA used for their RS-25, shuttle and then previously before that Apollo engines, but they used the stand for NASA engines. That's a massive stand. I was looking at the picture of it. It's about 30 stories tall, and you've got an engine inside, and that's how you test it. So this guy's serious. He's already starting to work on it. He has plans on eventually doing away with the hydrogen fuel lines and tanks that normally supplied the RS-25 engines for the shuttle. He's going to do away with that because this new rocket, this new Glenn rocket, is going to be a liquid methane, liquid oxygen system. So he's now going to install everything to do with methane. And hopefully he eventually develops it. His first planned launch would be early 2021 of the new Glenn. Now, the engines are so well made that, and tested already, that the United Launch Alliance, which consists of Boeing and Lockheed, they teamed up together. I've already made deals with Jeff Bezos at Blue Origin to buy these engines, these B-4 engines, 500,000 pound thrust or more, and they plan on putting two of them in the bottom of their new rocket that they've been developing for quite a few years now, called the Vulcan rocket. The Vulcan rocket is the rocket that's eventually going to replace the Atlas V rocket. Atlas V rocket is very successful, and they've done probably almost 100 flights, if not more. Successfully, not one failure, 100% rate on the Atlas V. But eventually they're going to be replaced. The government does not want to use their engines anymore. The engines are made by Russia, and the idea is to move away from the RD-180 engines. And to do that, originally they were thinking about maybe building engines and putting it into the Atlas V, but that whole idea has pretty much gone out the window because they had plans on building the Vulcan brand new rocket anyway. And Vulcan rocket's going to be, human rated. They'll be able to put people on. And they plan on using two of these engines, like I said. So I thought that was pretty good. The difference between the new Glenn and the new Vulcan rocket is the same engines. New Glenn has seven, Vulcan has two, but both vehicles, New Glenn plans on having reusable boosters, and he plans on landing his booster, seven brand new engines, on a ship out in the middle of the ocean, similar to what Elon Musk with SpaceX does. It'll launch from Cape Canaveral and eventually from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. The new Glenn will take off and the booster will come down and land on the drone ship, and they'll bring it back to Cape Canaveral, refurbish it, and send it up again. So now, naturally, that's going to cut way back on the cost. And ULA, which is the United Launch Alliance, Lockheed and Boeing, have a problem. The cost of their rocket, which only has two engines, is going to be very expensive because the original plan was not, was to have, they were going to throw them away. Evolved expendable launch vehicles, they call them EELV. They were just going to send them into the drink like we've been doing for 50 years. But now they need to compete. They got to drive the price down, and they need to save these engines, these V4 engines that they're buying from Blue Origin. And they've decided on a way that they would save these things. It, it, they don't want to save the booster itself, the tanks, but they do want to save the expensive part of the two engines that will be going up on the Vulcan. They're planning on an inflatable heat shield that will open up. The engines will come down with this inflatable heat shield, a massive thing. The test vehicle heat shield is around 20 feet. They plan on eventually having maybe 50 foot diameter inflatable heat shields to save rocket engines, or for that matter, landing heavy multi-ton vehicles on Mars. You'd be able to use this inflatable heat shield land, let's say, 20, 30, 40 tons of stuff on Mars. Someday you're going to need to do that if you're going to put humans on that planet, and vehicles that will eventually be able to take off and come back to Earth. And they've been working on this for quite a few years. They're called HIADs, hypersonic inflatable aerodynamic accelerators. So essentially, they're a bunch of circular tubes that are all folded up inside of the rocket, and then they inflate, and they're able to withstand the high temperatures coming down through the atmosphere. So they're actually going to send one up. I put it onto roy.ac2gs.com's website of what this thing is going to look like. And, what it is they actually have a different name for it. It's not going to be called the HIAD. That's the one that they've been working on. They actually gave this one a different name. This is a test vehicle, and it's an LOFTID, Loft ID, and it's they're big on acronyms. It's Low Earth Flight Test Inflatable Decelerator. And it's going to be launched in 2021, and it's on Roy's website, and it's pretty cool. I've looked into how they make this thing and what it's made of. The outside is made out of a woven silicone wrapper. One second. Silicone carbon. Carbide, actually. So the same thing you would use for a sanding type of thing. You could take sandpaper and apply silicone carbide on it. It's that material, but it's not in the weave. It's a process that weaves around these gigantic tubes. The tubes inside the silicone carbide, the materials, they've got this stuff that will hold the nitrogen, whatever this thing's going to be filled up with, from leaking. They've done extensive tests on this, and they still got some time to go, because the first launch of this vehicle is going to be in 2021, and that's just to test this thing, make sure this whole system works. They've done similar tests. We talked about it on this net a while back in 2015 with a similar type of thing. They launched from into space from a, they dropped it from a plane, I believe, on a Pegasus rocket. And it got into near space, and the thing opened up and came back down, and it turned out to be successful. But that was done by JPL, so it's a little different style, different material. This is being done between the United Launch Alliance and NASA. So hopefully that goes well. We'll have to see what happens. But if you want that information in, I did send a website over to Roy, and he said he's going to print it out. It might be there now onto his website, where you can click on it, and it's probably about 3 or 4 pages all about this topic, how eventually that this thing's going to come back through the atmosphere. It's going to have a parachute to open up after it's gone through the heating part as it went through the atmosphere. Parachutes will open up, and it's a parasail type of parachute, which will be able to guide it to a certain direction. They'll have a helicopter standing by. Helicopter will fly above the parachute and grab a hold of this thing, and they'll be able to bring there, well, this first flight, they'll be able to bring it back to make sure everything works, but in the future, they'll be able to